The views and opinions expressed during this podcast are those of our guests. No one person speaks for AA as a whole.
The GSO Archives Department was established in 1975, and it began with a simple act of foresight. GSO's first archivist, Nell Wing, Bill W.'s secretary at the time, realized that the everyday documents passing through the General Service Office might one day become a part of AA's history. So she started saving them, sometimes pulling them straight out of the wastebaskets. Over the next 50 years, those few saved papers have grown into a vast treasure trove of AA history. But preserving the past is only part of what Archives does. In this episode, we'll explore the many ways the GSO Archives Department gathers, protects, and shares AA's story, making it available to the fellowship to help carry the message of hope and recovery. My name is Nathan, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the GSO Archives. AA history is a living thing, and it lives in the stories we share with each other. One of the most powerful places to see that happen is at the Old Timers Meeting during the International Convention, where AA members with 50 or more years of sobriety share their experience, strength, and hope with tens of thousands of people gathered from around the world. If you haven't heard it yet, check out the first episode of this season. At the Old Timers Meeting, 12 members are chosen at random to tell their stories. But at the 2025 International Convention in Vancouver, British Columbia, something interesting happened. The member with the most sobriety who had signed up, 65 years, wasn't chosen. And the crowd noticed. Well, guess what? We got him on the podcast.
Hello.
His name is Otto W. from Medford, Oregon, and at the time of our phone call, he had 66 years of sobriety.
Well, I'm always willing to talk to AA people.
After recording our conversation, I shared Otto's interview with GSO Archives Director Michelle Mirza.
Happy to be here.
And digital archivist Jamie Fritz.
Thanks for having us, Nathan.
Then we listened to Otto's story together, this time through an archival lens. Where do we start, Otto?
Let me start by giving you my sobriety date.
Please do.
My sobriety date is August the 20th of 1959. I have been sober since that time. I sobered up in Compton, California. I'm 95 years old. I'm a Korean veteran. And I was in the Veterans Hospital in 1956. They didn't have any treatment for alcoholism in those days. Alcoholism was considered, it wasn't even considered. The majority of the guys that I was locked up with in the lock ward were alcoholic, probably 90% alcoholic.
So, Michelle, one of the first things Otto talks about is getting sober in Compton, California. Does GSO Archives have any information about AA in California in the 50s and 60s?
I would say that in the 1950s and 1960s, certainly California is a large state, and we are aware of thousands of AA groups existing at the time, simply based on the listings in the old AA directories.
But there could very well be far more AA groups. These are just the ones that we know about because they're the ones that listed.
We encourage groups to list with the General Service Office and or their local central office or intergroups. So GSO Archives may not always have comprehensive information about new groups.
Then Otto says he is a Korean War veteran. Any history of AA during the Korean War? Is there any correspondence or anything?
So as far as AA activity during the Korean War, there were letters to the office as early as 1948. So these were folks who were already in Korea doing AA work there with individuals who they were meeting who were in the fellowship. And during the war, there were a lot of military personnel who, again, were writing into GSO about where they were being posted and different places that they were moving around so that they could try to meet other folks in the military who would want to, you know, hold a meeting. There was an issue of AA Today in 1960 where they talk about this a little bit. And the quote is, "Knowing things about wartime Korea that not even our army generals knew, the World Service Office reached out 7,000 miles away in 1952 to put one AA member in the U.S. Army there in touch with another. Others stationed in Korea began to write in. A check of grapevine circulation lists dug up a few more. And by means of some cloak and dagger work, eventually 15 sober AA members got together during the Korean War to help each other stay sober.
That is awesome. That is a great find. You mentioned AA Today. What was that?
AA Today was a special publication by the Grapevine. I believe it was published in 1960 in time for the 1960 International Convention. It was a wonderful booklet filled with historical information and messages from friends of the fellowship at the time.
Otto was first introduced to AA at a veterans hospital. Bill W. and Dr. Bob found the third member of AA in a hospital, and a lot of 12-step work initially happened in hospitals. Is there any official history of cooperation between AA and medical facilities?
The passage of time strengthened the view of alcoholism as a disease. And as inquiries grew, naturally the office developed a pamphlet titled Patterns of AA Hospital Cooperation. And this guide outlined the principles of the AA program. Also very important, the need to involve the AA communities, right? Like sponsors and sober alcoholics into their program, as well as it suggested or pointed to AA literature and other practical resources. So AA has had a cooperation with hospital institutions from the very beginning.
They had a new psychiatrist, and he came up to me on the ward and said, we're going to have a couple of guys come in from AA, and I'd like you to spend some time with them. And so I said, sure, because they had something I wanted, and I was willing to go to any length to get it. And that was matches. They used to give us cigarettes, but they used to shut our fire off about 9 o'clock at night. They wouldn't light any cigarettes. And so my motive in going to my first AA meeting was to get matches. No other reason. They locked us in a room together, two guys and myself. And I did get the idea that there were a couple of guys staying sober who were because as they talked, they convinced me that they were alcoholics. They were sober. And so that was in March of 1956. So I was 25 years old. So I got out and I went to an AA meeting. And I got a copy of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I would go to a meeting once in a while and stay for a little bit and then walk out. But then for 3 years, until August the 19th of 1959, I drank periodically. And I was a periodic drunk. At the end of 3 years, I was working for an outfit. And I won't get into details, but they fired me. And I was on a drunk, and I just had enough. You know, enough of me, enough of the booze, enough of the consequences. I made a decision that morning, August the 19th, to come back to Alcoholics. Well, I'd never really been, but to give it, like they say in those poker deals, I'm all in. And that's what I decided that morning. I just was all in. Like, sick of the drunken likes. I sobered up 2 days before my 29th birthday. And so I ended up in the Compton Sunday night meeting, and I was to meet the guys that I was to be with for the rest of their lives. Little Whitey sat down next to me. Whitey and I ended up going through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every night we'd go to a meeting, and then we'd go to his kitchen and read a little bit out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'd talk about it. And when they came to a step, we would take the step. As best we could. And that's the way we went through the first 164 pages of the Big Book. It took us about a year to do that. But we did a little at a time at night after the meeting.
Are you still active in AA?
I'm very active in Alcoholics Anonymous still at 95 years old. I've been very blessed in that I am disabled. I got frozen legs in Korea and wounded. I'm an Oregon wounded warrior, but I still get around pretty good.
What about your family life?
I've been married twice. They're both gone now. My first wife died of lung cancer. She liked to smoke, and it ended up killing her. And my second wife, we were together 30 years, and she got a brain tumor. She was very active in AA as well over a long time.
And you stayed sober through all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. If I were to take one drink, see, I can't take one drink. If I were to take one drink, everything would go.
Do you have any recollections you could share about your first home group?
Sure, lots of them. We met, and there was a housing district called Victory Park, and they had a school in Victory Park, and we met in the school auditorium on Sunday night.
Jamie, his first home group was in a district called Victory Park. Are there any archives of groups in Victory Park back then?
So as far as that area, the earliest records that we were able to find were from a new group formed in 1995. And that doesn't mean that there wasn't AA activity around there earlier. In fact, sometimes folks will write into us asking for group histories, and we give them the best estimate that we have of when their group started based on the information that we have at GSO. And folks in the group will write back and say, that doesn't sound right. I know that we started 5-10 years before that because we were meeting in this place. And that's an opportunity for us to say, great, if you do know that, if you can show us that, we would love to add it. We would love for it to be more accurate. You know your group history best, and we're working with what we have. So, you know, help us improve that.
And we were supposed to start at 8 o'clock. And we usually did, and it was supposed to go until 9:30, and oftentimes we were still there at midnight. You know, they say a meeting has to start on time and end on time. Well, we didn't practice that very well.
Michelle, Otto's first group intended to have 90-minute meetings. They didn't always follow that. There are meetings that are 90 minutes, and some can be shorter. It's usually by group conscience. If everybody shares or no one has anything else to share, sometimes a group conscience will say, you know, we could end a little bit early. But for the most part, they're about an hour long, at least in my experience here in the U.S. and Canada. But is there a history on the one-hour meeting practice?
Good question. It's difficult to establish exact time period, but undoubtedly, at least as early as the 1940s, you know, one-hour meetings have been in practice. And meeting duration differed by localities and also by groups. But there is correspondence in delving into the archives. There's correspondence as early as 1941, noting one-hour meetings, or at least endeavoring, right? At least endeavoring to maintain a one-hour meeting.
Yes, we are always endeavoring to be on time, to start on time, to end on time.
In this podcast, we respect the anonymity of AA members. Last names are shared only for those who are not in AA.
Otto, when you came into AA, Alcoholics Anonymous was relatively new compared to where we are now, right, after 90 years. In your experience in LA in the 60s and 70s, what was it like trying to get people help with getting detoxed?
I came in before treatment. They didn't have treatment. There wasn't any detox. There wasn't anything for alcoholics. So Alcoholics Anonymous was the main avenue of help for alcoholism. Our central offices, we had one in Long Beach, we had one in L.A. They were busy all the time with 12-step work because the hospitals wouldn't take them. You couldn't get an alcoholic into the hospital because, you know, they usually didn't pay and they were poor risk and a pain in the ass most of the time. So you couldn't get them into a hospital. Sometimes we'd just sign them in and leave them, and then they had to take them. But most of the time, we used to feed them what they called AA cocktail. That was caro syrup and orange juice to get their blood sugar up.
Yeah.
Keep them from going into DT. But we sobered up a lot of people. I mean, that was what we did.
Michelle, what about the AA cocktail? Did that really happen? We heard that it could be a myth. Was it a myth?
That's a fun question. Not a myth. They, in the early days, drank caro syrup by the cupfuls. In fact, I have come across archival materials retelling stories of early members literally armed with their bottles of caro syrup and their big book and the traditions on 12-step calls. I mean, it's hilarious. Alcoholics were fed a diet of sauerkraut, carob syrup, and some sugary drink like orange juice, which were intended to help reduce the sugar cravings and also provide energy. So it's not a myth. And in fact, it is well known that Dr. Bob was fed such a special diet to steady his own hands and sober him up before performing surgery. You can read more about it in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers.
Otto, are there any observations you want to share about Alcoholics Anonymous, the organization or the program, how it's remained the same over the years, how it's changed? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it had changed a little bit because of treatment. 65 years ago, there were a lot of people that came in that were last gaspers. In other words, everything was gone. And now we have, you know, like in my group in the morning, and one of the guys, John, this morning, is a brain surgeon. We're getting him a lot sooner than we would years ago. We're getting college students and, you know, and they're just as alcoholic as anybody else, but they're identifying earlier in life. And we're seeing that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you've probably seen it in Alcoholics Anonymous. That we're getting people a lot sooner than they're not last gaspers.
Otto talked about younger people coming to AA. Is there any history of Bill W. working with young people? Jamie's already smiling.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite. So I had taken a look at this before we discussed it. And I've looked at it a few times because I think it's so funny and it's still so relevant. So in 1968, a member named Lib wrote to Bill and said that there was a, and I want to quote this because the language in the letter is so great, said that in Lib's area in West Texas, there was a, quote, cult forming among the young people embracing the hippie movement. So, yeah, so the letter goes on to say basically that there were these concerns from some of the old timers in the area that the young people, these young hippies, they were only holding their own meetings. They only wanted to do step work among themselves. And, you know, that essentially they weren't engaging with the rest of the folks in AA in the area. And Lib says, the members who have a length of sobriety are said by them to be politically dead in AA and they plan to take over. Wow. So Bill wrote back and essentially says, you know, that he understands that there are concerns when there are big changes happening in an area, that there are, you know, generational concerns, that those are, you know, not new things. And he mentions that a group of young people had visited GSO after a young people's conference in Toronto. And he says that there were hippies among them. You know, there were love beads, there was long hair, there were sandals, all those kinds of things. And he was a little taken aback because it just wasn't something he was too used to seeing. So he decided to take them all out to lunch. So he has a nice lunch with these young folks and he writes to Lib that he thought they were absolutely fantastic and that he learned a lot about the reasons why they wanted to start out sort of interacting with their own younger community. You know, they're sharing these experiences, they're getting used to sobriety, getting used to being in AA. And there was a lot of value for them in having that space for themselves, but that the longer they stuck around, the more they learned about the structure, they would start to branch out and sort of become part of that larger AA community. So he writes to Lib and he says, listen, just try to talk to them. It will probably work itself out. They just need time, you know, to sort of get acclimated. And I think it's so sweet because Lib writes back in early 1969. And she says, you know, I took your advice. I met them with open mind, open heart, and they're wonderful. And just goes on and on about how a few of the old timers started really getting to know these younger people. And now the young people are in all of their meetings. They're helping to pay the rent on the meeting room spaces. And they have this great relationship. So it's one of my favorites because I think it's something that happens in every generation. And I think it was so interesting that even Bill said, you know, I get it. It's new. It's different. It might be a little bit scary, but we just have to keep communicating with each other and, you know, hope that we find that common ground.
That is an awesome story. I can see why it's one of your favorites. Thank you for sharing that.
To find a meeting near you or a meeting online, download the Meeting Guide app on your mobile device.
Have you done much service in AA in the group level or further down the triangle?
Well, I've been a GSR. I've been a secretary of a different group, but I'm more of a coffee maker type guy, okay? And the set up and tear down and that kind of thing. And I still do that kind of stuff. My group has a camp out every August up in the hills here. And I'm the coffee maker. At 5 o'clock in the morning, I have 400 cups of coffee ready.
Does GSO Archives have any history of coffee in AA?
Yeah, so there was a 1953 conference highlights article in the Grapevine where they say the 9 conference sessions lasted 152 gallons of coffee worth. This tops the report on coffee consumption of the first conference, 15,664 coffee beans. At that 1951 meeting, there were 383,412 words spoken, or roughly 25 beans per word.
I am not envious of the person who had the job of counting every single coffee bean. But, you know, service is service. We're grateful for all of it.
Coffee has always been a staple at AA meetings. You know, it was served in Bill's home when meetings were initially in private homes, certainly Dr. Bob's home and so forth and so forth. However, we always want to validate what we communicate as archivists, right? We want to validate what we communicate to those who, you know, ask us questions by sourcing primary records. And primary records meaning, you know, any original unpublished materials like personal letters. So I was able to quickly find it by conducting a search of our digitized records. And our digital archivist is leading our commitment to prioritize digitizing and preserving AA's historical materials, not only materials compiled in the past, but materials that we are assembling today.
So Jamie, as digital archivist, walk us through it.
Like Michelle said, I think my work is split between digitizing things that already exist in our archives that are already part of that historical record and digitizing or preserving new materials that were already created digitally. So the big difference is that when we're working with older material, the priority is often longevity. So we want to make sure that a piece of material that might be fragile or might be deteriorating in some way, that we have a copy of that that we can ensure is lasting long term so that we can use it for research so that, you know, it remains part of that record. And I think with the newer records, it's certainly less glamorous. I don't think there's anything awe-inspiring about like a PDF file right now, the way that you would look at a 100-year-old letter and maybe feel something about that physical object. But it does function the same way. So the folks who are working on our committees now, the people who are sending us digital records about their groups, I think that will have the same impact 25, 50, 100 years down the road that, you know, we feel now looking at things from, you know, the 1930s. The techniques are a lot different, but the goal really is the same, which is just to have a copy that we can ensure will be safe and will be accessible and will be findable for us to use as long as we possibly can.
Did you ever get in touch with the General Service Office, Otto, or been in touch with the GSO before now?
Yes. In 1964, I became an engineer. I was at work one day and the medical director said, we need somebody to start an employee assistance program. And the word had gotten around that I had helped a few people in the company. So they said, we would like you to come and join our medical staff. So I said, well, I don't know anything about that end of the business. And they said, well, we'll put you through school. And so I went back to school and I was on the medical staff for 11 years. But during that time, before I would do anything, I would call a General Service Office, anything that related to AA, if I had a question. And so I would call the General Service Office. That was in 1969.
How about employee assistance programs, Michelle?
With regard to EAP employee assistance programs, I think one might consider the chapter in the Big Book to employers as the earliest example of outreach addressing alcoholism in the workplace. In the early 1940s, this chapter was actually reprinted entitled, What About the Alcoholic Employee? So that is one of the earliest experiences. And certainly by the 1950s and continuing through the 1960s, EAP programs began to flourish, right, appear across the country. Out of this vast experience emerged a study on AA's relationship with outside agencies as directed by the General Service Conference. And naturally, literature developed to help guide industries, corporations, businesses interested in setting up their own EAP programs, you know, with guidelines. And interesting enough, Nathan, in our own archives, we have a decent collection of early letters and original copies of EAP programs from industries as they were establishing their own programs.
For more information about AA, please visit our website at aa.org.
Do you have any memories of your interactions with the General Service Office?
It's been a long time ago, you know. But I had questions concerning anonymity. So I will call the General Service Office and just ask them bluntly, you know, is this a violation?
And what kind of responses do you remember?
Well, they would just tell me their experience. They wouldn't tell me what to do, but they would tell me their experience, what they had gone through. So
you found it helpful contacting GSO?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, because you know, we were kind of flying by the seat of our pants on that sort of a thing. So we really didn't know. And when I would call, I had legitimate questions. Like I say, they didn't tell me exactly what to do. They just said, this is our experience.
Yeah.
And they would go through their experience with me, which would guide me into a decision.
Any other memories from your early days in AA?
I got to meet Bill Wilson in 1960 at the International Conference in Long Beach, California.
Go on.
The headquarters of the Roundup, or International Roundup, was at the Lafayette Hotel. So I had made a real ass of myself, and I won't get into detail on that, in the hotel lounge. So I went to the lounge to kind of look at the area where I had made a fool of myself, and Bill Wilson was there. And I got to talk with him for a few minutes. So,
do you remember the nature of the conversation?
No, just general stuff. You know, he'd asked where I was from, and I told him. And I think I told him what I was doing there. We both laughed.
Do you have any highlights from that international in Long Beach, California, 1960?
The 1960 convention was fun to look at. I think because it was in California, just in that era, there's great graphic design. The events were really fun. So the host committee was arranging trips to Disneyland, to Knott's Berry Farm. The big show was a Hollywood review. So there were some hints to that, like, Hollywood flash at the time. But it was a pretty big convention. I think one of the most interesting things that I found while I was doing research was that 1960 was the first international convention to advertise an alkathon.
Could you explain to our listeners what an alkathon is?
Yeah, so an alkathon is a series of meetings that take place throughout the course of a day. So in this case, in 1960, there were 14 hourly meetings. Sometimes they're longer. I'm sure they can be a little bit shorter as well. This first one was 14 hours. It was advertised in the grapevine in advance of the convention. So there was just a little note that said, alkathon, what is it? Come to California and find out. And there was a daily bulletin that was run during the convention just to keep people updated about what kind of events were going on. And they also had an article about it, and the title was Only Alkies Could Dream Up Alkathon. See you at 2 a.m.
Otto, thank you very much. This has been a real pleasure. I hope I get to meet you in person someday, maybe at the next international convention in St. Louis.
Well, we'll see. Okay. I'm still in good health at 95, so we'll see.
Jamie, Michelle, really grateful you spent some time with us today. This was great.
Thank you so much. This was really fun.
Thank you, Nathan. This was really fun.
Oh, I repeated what Jamie said. That was in my head.
You can always reach the Archives Department by emailing archives@aa.org. Our next episode is the season 2 finale, and for it, we are doing something very different. So come on back. You do not want to miss it.
Thank you for listening to Our Primary Purpose, a podcast produced by the General Service Office on behalf of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in the U.S. and Canada.